Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Not many cars being sold in America right now, but over the last century, millions and millions have been bought and sold. And every time, it's a dance, a ritual, a contest, a deal. It's not quite like buying anything else in America. Trade-ins and bargains, test drives and add-ins, and war room negotiations for the best deal in town. My guest today, historian Stephen Gelber, traces the ritual back to real horse trading. This hour, On Point remembering the buying and selling of cars. You can join the conversation. What's your best, your worst story of wheeling and dealing on the showroom floor? Why is buying a car not quite like buying anything else? Joining me right now from Fremont, California, is Stephen Gelber, professor of history at Santa Clara University and author of the new book, Horse Trading in the Age of Cars, Men in the Marketplace. Professor Gelber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really looking forward to diving in with you. Let's dive into just a little bit of the sound that people have heard over many decades here. You take it right down to the showroom floor, but across this country, the selling of cars has lived in and around our minds and lives for a long time. Here's a 1952 Chevrolet ad, a classic featuring Dinah Shore.
So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
Traveling east, traveling west, wherever you go, Chevy service is best.
1952, fast forward 1969, commercial for the 69 Pontiac GTO, also called The Judge, sung by Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Judge, the special great one from Pontiac GTO. Her speed shifted, 3 feet or four, Pontiac Clam Air.
And right up to date, here's a commercial from Eastern Motors, Maryland, Virginia, used car dealership. They're famous locally for the Eastern Motors rap.
Ford, Honda, Chevy, Beamers, and minivans, over 600 cars, trucks, SUVs. Are you listening, man? Let Eastern Motors put you in a car today. Let Eastern Motors finance it.
Right. Professor, are you in the mood for a little car buying out there in California?
Well, nobody's ever in the mood for car buying. Everybody loves cars but hates buying them.
Well, you are taking us right back here, describing more or less a century of car buying and selling. And interestingly, you take it all the way back to horse trading, and you make a real kind of literal connection. Take us all the way back to the very beginning. What was going on? I mean, I've got pictures in here of mule trading going on in your
That's
book
right.
about selling cars. Where's
right.
the point of intersection? In history,
the
first,
argument
I guess.
That I the argument that I make in the book is that there's a continuity between the way men bought and sold personal transportation when the personal transportation were horses, and the way they bought and buy and sell personal transportation when the personal transportation are cars. That what the continuity is in the style of the buying and selling, not in the product that is being bought and sold.
And you're saying men advisedly there. You specifically mean men, but everybody has to get around and did then too, didn't they?
Yes. Well, when the transportation was horses, it was almost always men who bought and sold them. It was almost always men who rode and drove them. It was unusual for a woman to drive a carriage or to ride a horse, although it was done, of course. And it was even more unusual for a woman to buy or sell a horse. That was a strictly male game. And I use the word game very specifically because when individuals bought and sold horses, they saw it as a contest, as a game in which there was a winner and a loser. And sometimes the buying and the selling was as important as the actual owning of the horse. It was a machismo sort of thing. It was a male sort of thing, and the winner would boast, and the loser would slink away.
Anybody who's been on the automobile showroom floor knows that that dynamic has hardly gone away. That kind of must be a winner and a loser gladiator contest. But the tradition of shenanigans, you also take right back to the horse and mule trading.
Yes.
What kind of shenanigans? Not many Americans, you know, go out and dicker over horses much anymore as an everyday auto buying kind of thing. What went on with horses, shenanigans wise?
Well, of course, everybody's familiar with the expression that you're not supposed to look a gift horse in the mouth. The reason you're not supposed to look a gift horse in the mouth is that you can, at least until the age of 8, roughly tell how old a horse is. Mm. And obviously, the younger the horse, the more desirable, since it will live longer. And a gift horse might not be as young as you would like it to be, but so you don't. Now, if you're selling a horse, not giving it away as a gift, you want the buyer to think that the horse is younger than it is. And as a horse ages, as it chews its food, it grinds down its teeth, and so its molars become smoother.
Yeah.
So one of the ways of indicating or faking the fact that a horse is younger or looks younger than it is to actually dig. They would use a variety of horse dental tools and hot irons, dig pits into the horse's molars so the horse looked younger. Once a horse reached the age of 8, you couldn't tell. And so, as one commentator in the 19th century said, nobody ever sold a horse that was older than 8 years old because, you know, even if his teeth were ground down, you'd always say, well, yeah, it's an 8 year old.
Right.
And the tooth doctoring, which was also called bishoping, mm-hmm. and nobody quite knows where that term comes from, but bishoping teeth, horses' teeth, was the equine equivalent of rolling back the odometer.
Mm-hmm.
It made the vehicle, or made the animal, younger, look less used than it actually was.
Rolling back the odometer in the mouth, doctoring the teeth, plugging a sick horse's nose with rope to keep it from sneezing, even pepping up older horses with nitroglycerin? What?
Well, nitroglycerin was one way of doing it. There was an equivalent, particularly in the earlier part of the 20th century, of juicing up the gasoline in cars so they would burn hotter and run faster. But nitroglycerin was one thing, and the other was to stimulate a horse to be more active by putting hot pepper in its anus. Nothing like that to make you dance around and look young.
Never mind STP.
Or dropping pebbles in its ears. If you drop a pebble in a horse's ears, it's very uncomfortable. It keeps shaking its head to try to get them out. And it looks like a frisky young thing, even if it's old and sick.
So there was a culture established in the buying and selling, the trading of horses, typically among men early on. And you describe an almost literal handoff here. You describe at least one early Ford dealer, John Eagle, I guess, who took horses in trade for Model Ts as late as 1909. He had a hustler, a horse handler on staff, even as he bought and sold cars and took horses in trade for automobiles.
He actually had his what we would today call his dealership or his store,
yeah,
was divided down the middle. On one side there were horses, on the other side there were cars. And he would take horses in trade. And his hostler, sometimes they were called a jockey, would evaluate the horse and tell you how much of a trade-in you would get on your new car as you were making the transition from 4 feet to four wheels. And so the idea of you know, Horse Trader Ed, your local car dealer, he may not know it, but he is making a connection that was very direct in the early part of the 20th century.
Get a timetable in our mind's eye, if you will. When I'm not sure most people really know on a calendar when automobiles began really showing up, I guess first for the few and then for the many. What was the trend? Over what time period did the handoff between horses and autos take shape?
The first automobiles appear on the roads about 1895. But it's not until just after the turn of the century that they become more widely available, first to very wealthy people, and then after 1908 with the Model T Ford to a much wider audience of middle and even to some extent working class, although not really extensively, buyers. So you can figure about 1908 is the year when you can see the end of horses. Horses don't disappear. They won't disappear for another 20 or 30 years even. But if you're in 1908 and you're looking around, the future is definitely cars, and there's no question that everybody at some point is going to have or want to have an automobile.
Was it the same people selling cars who had sold horses? Were they sold out of stables?
To some extent. In fact, no one was quite sure where a car should be sold, and that's one of the interesting characteristics. It was a manufactured product. Every horse is different. Nobody knows what's going on inside a horse, and so buying a horse is always a bit of a risk. But every car, at least in theory, every car that's the same model is exactly the same car.
Stephen Gilbert, hold the thought right there, if you would. We've got to take a short break right here. We'll be right back to learn much more. We're talking about buying and selling cars. Stephen Gilbert's new book is Horse Trading in the Age of Cars. Here's a 1950 Chevy ad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Quickly, comfortably, and with utmost economy. Travel this year the roads to romance, to places you have always wanted to go. And when you travel, go in one of the quality motor cars your Chevrolet dealer has to offer. It will be your magic carpet that will carry you to the land of your heart's desire.
We're talking this hour about buying and selling cars. Not bailouts in Washington, but the history of horse trading on the showroom floor. Professor of History at Santa Clara University, Stephen Gilbert, is with us. His new book is Horse Trading in the Age of Cars, Men in the Marketplace. And he's talking about some pretty literal sort of spillover, carryover from the age of trading horses to the age of buying and selling cars. Here's another Chevy commercial, 1950, featured footage of an experiment testing the car's sturdy build.
Your Chevrolet is built to take a lot of punishment, far beyond anything you will ever give to it. Just how much will it take? Well, Chevrolet engineers put the car through plenty of torture to find out. And here's a special test to prove what this car is made of. Towed along at over 40 miles an hour, the car is released as a ramp smashes against the front wheel with tons of force. And Chevrolet can take it standing up.
Can take it standing up. Everybody knows what it's like to get out into that arena. Let's get a call right here from Andover, Connecticut. And Tom, hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick comment. I'm 57, and I always seem to find myself buying new cars. And just listening to your show, it made me think back.
Brings it all back, yeah.
Brings it all back. Well, I guess what brings it back was going with my father to buy a new car. It was a skill. My mother never wanted to go. She, didn't want to have anything to do with it. My father would take me, and he would make sure I'd sit there and watch the whole deal, the whole horse trade thing.
Was this when you were still a boy or when you were old?
This was when I was a boy, mm-hmm. through my whole life.
So a kind of rite of passage. So you would learn at the...
It was a rite of passage, yeah. Absolutely. And when I bought my first car, he sent me off on my own. He gave me some tips. He said, now I'm going to let you do this on your own. Make sure you do this. Make sure you do that. And it was just a wonderful time for me. The whole thing was just a great experience, a great memory. And
what do you remember seeing and learning, Tom?
Well, never take the first offer. Never get upset. You know, always try to get a better price. If you couldn't get a better price, try to get some options. They didn't have the options back then that they have now. But my father was always looking for a better deal, and never to accept the offer. Always to walk out.
Right.
And, you know, tell him that you would think about it and then come back. And you know, give it a couple of days, no matter what they said, and things like that.
Stephen, here it is, laid right out for us by Tom, the sort of
Absolutely.
Passing from father to son of how
Absolutely.
You do this horse trading.
And it's a guy thing. It's a rite, as you said, it was a rite of passage, like going out to hunt your first deer or going fishing for the first time with your dad. It was a male thing passed on from father to son, and women were excluded. Historically, when women went to buy cars, they would take along a buying buddy, and the buying buddy was usually male, a father, a brother, a boyfriend, a husband, somebody who could who knew how to play the game, which girls were not supposed to play.
Tom, thanks so much for your call. But yet, Stephen, you've got right at the front of your book this wonderful ad from way back, I don't know, 1920, 23, and it's from a car company long gone and forgotten. Who knows what will be forgotten a century from now? It's called the Jordan Motor Car Company. They're selling a car of all things called the Playboy, really jazzy-looking roadster. And the illustration is it's plowing along some great road we don't know. It looks like it's in the Wild West. And alongside it is actually a cowboy on horseback, whooping the horse with his cowboy hat. But the text is, somewhere west of Laramie, there's a there's a bronco-busting, steer-roping girl who knows what I'm talking about. What?
Yes. That ad is not only a classic car ad, it's a classic advertising piece. It's generally considered the first example of selling not the product, but the lifestyle, selling the sizzle, not the steak. And the fact that it is a woman driving this roadster, as I point out in the book, the same sort of car that Nancy Drew and her buddies her chums would ride a few years later in her detective stories for young girls, is an indication of the switch over to women being drivers and women being more independent. And in fact, it was modeled after Ned Jordan's daughter, who Ned Jordan was the owner of the automobile company. Nevertheless, if that young woman was going in to buy a car, even though she was going to drive it and perhaps own it herself, she almost certainly would have taken a man with her to do the actual negotiating for the price.
It's just a wonderful, it's built for the lass whose face is brown with the sun. When the day is done of revel and romp and race, she loves the cross of the wild and the tame. You know, drive the Playboy. That's amazing. Out in somewhere west of Laramie. Let's get a call from Hartsville, South Carolina, and Karen. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Little interesting history. I have two photographs that were taken in England of my great-grandfather's shop in about 1920.
Okay.
The first one was Dickings Harness and Saddle Shop.
Yep.
By 1925, I have a picture of the exact same building, but now it's Dickings and Sons Motor Engineering.
There it is. Harness and Saddle to Motor Engineering.
Right.
Is the family still in the business, Karen, or is that ancient history now?
Well, my grandfather had garages clear up until the 1950s in England.
So
he's passed away, and nobody else is in that line of work that I know of.
Karen, do you buy cars, or do you send somebody out to do it?
No, I still play with horses.
Good for you. Lucky you. What an image. Thanks very much for sharing it. Let's get one more here from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Nicholas. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I used to work for IBM in the mid-70s, where GM hired us to write a program, computer programming, for this relationship between dealers and GM. How much would dealers pay for each vehicle?
Why did they need a computer program for that, Nicholas?
Well, they're trying to keep track of these things, and the funniest part is that all of this horse trading that you guys are talking about had to be integrated into the software, into the program. One of the things that I noticed was nowhere was the mention of how much it costs to make the vehicle. That was never entered into it. How much the actual vehicle cost, the components, weren't a factor. It was the relationship between the dealer and GM, it was how well the dealers could do, how many vehicles a month that they could sell, dictated what the dealer would pay for the vehicle.
But so, costs weren't an issue, meaning it was, in some large portion, a kind of cultural question.
More than you would think that, okay, it costs this much to manufacture the vehicle, and then this is how much profit we want to make, and so this is what the vehicle should cost. That wasn't a factor at all. It was simply how the dealer was going to, the inputs to the computer program were how well the dealer did as far as sales, how much he could, how many trade-ins he could get, these sorts of factors. And so the monetary value, the sticker price, if you will, was a made-up thing. It never had anything to do with actually how much the vehicle cost, and it was different depending on what part of the country you were from.
That is great. The image of IBM trying to get a computer program wrapped around the very cultural, human, mano-a-mano dickering that made the car price, Stephen Gelbert, it goes right to your theme of what an unusual product this was, both physically, industrially, and culturally.
Yes, culturally, one of the things I argue is we sometimes refer to, or cars were referred to as horseless carriages, but I like to think of them as horseless horses, in the sense that the car, like the horse, was a representation of the man who owned it in two senses. It was a male representation in the sense that the horse or the car represents you, and in that sense, it's big and strong and fast.
Yeah.
And tough.
Yeah.
And also, it's a female representation in the sense that it's yours. You own it. You possess it. You control it. People come and admire your thing. And there are some very specific examples. And so it has a kind of dual personality, but both of which represent the man who has gone out and won this means of transportation, won it first by earning the money to buy it, and won it secondly by fighting for it in this contest to get the best price.
But why didn't it ever just have a sales price put on it, a sticker put on it, like some other big, I don't know, a washing machine or fridge or dryer? Or,
exactly.
Why not?
It did, or they tried. For example, automobiles were sold briefly in the early part of the century by Sears Roebuck, through its catalog.
Oh.
Yes, through its catalog, and so there was a set price there. And by Wanamaker's, the large department store in Philadelphia. And they thought, well, here's a manufactured product like a radio or a washing machine, and we can sell that, and we can sell it the same way. But it didn't work out, and the weak point in the system was the trade-in. If you could sell a car and not have to worry about buying back the purchaser's current car, then you could simply say, okay, here is the price.
Right.
And that was what was done until World War II. But even though there was a price and you sold it for that price, the buyer expected you to buy back his current car. And of course, there's no price on that. And so the price that you pay for the used car, that is the price the dealer pays.
Sure, you've got to dicker and negotiate
car
over that. No
and
way around
so the
it.
Price of the, right, and so the price of the new car becomes variable even though there is a listed price.
And so the horse trading goes on.
No
so,
way to get around it.
Stephen,
after World War II, until 1959, car companies simply stopped advertising new prices. So they didn't even pretend anymore that there was a list price. You would go in and you would have no idea what the price was going to be, not only of your used car, of your trade-in, but you had no idea what the price of the new car was going to be. And so it was a four-way negotiation of old car, new car, how much you're going to pay on the loan. And the game became so complicated that only really the salesman could understand it. And the buyer was mostly a victim, although some people really liked it and expected it. And so there was no way to get out of the cultural pattern.
I want to talk about those wild 1950s years in particular. Let's get a call from Diane in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This really struck a chord with me.
I am 40 years old, a very, you know, independent woman, mm-hmm. started my own company, single mom,
yep.
lived all over the world. And for the first time in my life, I had to buy a new car. And I have a boyfriend. He's been my boyfriend for quite a while. So I told him, you know, Jesus, I've got to get a new car. And he
yep.
said, oh, gosh, you know, good luck. And I said, what? He said, well, good luck. I said, you're not letting me go buy a car by myself, are you?
Wait a minute. You're the big, strong, independent woman, Diane.
I know, and it was horrifying, and it caused this huge argument. And I'm on the phone calling my male friends who were shocked. He's not letting you go alone, is he? My family.
What kind of a man is he?
Exactly. They're like, well, you better rethink this guy. And so I was mad, and I did go, and I did my research, which is very easy now.
Online.
And I went,
right.
yeah, online.
Right.
And I went, and I did everything, you know, by the book, right. But I tell you, Tom, I still have this nagging suspicion that, I, you know, if he had come with
taken.
Me,
yep.
yeah, that I got taken.
Diane, yep. that is a great story, super illustrative, and I want to get some response
Classic.
For someone who knows this world and the ways of this world incredibly well. Diane, thanks for calling. Stephen Gilbert, standby in California.
Mm-hmm.
Joining us right now from Versailles, Kentucky, is Jack Kane, owner of Jack Kane Ford in Versailles, Kentucky. He's been in the auto sales business for over 50 years. Not just active at the local level, though. He was chairman of the National Automobile Dealers Association just a few years back in 2005. He's still on its board of directors. Jack Kane, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. And by the way, that's Versailles, Kentucky.
Versailles,
that's
excuse
me. That's what we call
it here. Puts the sales in Versailles.
That's right.
And pardon me for my Frenchified pronunciation
right.
there. But you just heard Diane, I think, along with the rest of us, Jack, talking about how her friends just came down on her boyfriend like a ton of bricks when he didn't offer to go along with her. Do you have to have a guy in the showroom to buy a car?
Well, most women bring one in still today. However, we have quite a few that are very independent now. And since you can do so much online, most of them know more about the car they're going to buy than our salesmen do. So it really makes a lot of difference from the time I started selling cars in 1947. When there was no sticker on the car, nothing at all. It was just you and the customer, and you knew the cost of it. He didn't. He couldn't find it anywhere in the world, whereas today you can find it anywhere you want to look.
Do you have women in your showroom? Do you have women selling cars at Jack Kane Ford now?
Yes, we do, and they are very good, and a lot of people like to talk with them. They just assume their credibility is up to par. However, most of our people are college educated. They make good money selling cars. They do a tremendous job. They're well educated onto the product of the car. And our company, Ford, just doesn't let us put anybody out there to sell cars. They have to be certified before they can sell a car. We have a person that stays here, works here for about a month before we turn him loose on the buying public.
Do you have gender rules? If a man walks in to buy a car, do you send him a man or a woman or whatever's
no,
up next?
No, sir. We do not. They all just it's very democratically done, and it's a process that most of your salespeople work out for themselves.
Well, there's a lot more we're going to learn right here. Jack Kane, please stand by in Versailles, Kentucky. Jack Kane of Jack Kane Ford. Stephen Gilbert with the new book, Horse Trading in the Age of Cars. We'll go out with Go See Cal, 1980s jingle from the Worthington dealership, Cal Worthington, famous on the West Coast. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
If you want to save a buck, if you want to change your luck, go see Cal. If you want a better buy, go see Cal. You're the highly satisfied, go see Cal. Give a new car to your wife, she will love you all her life. Go see Cal, go see Cal, go see Cal. Axle is a sagging, go see Cal.
Maybe need a station wagon, go see Cal. If your wife has started nagging and your tailpipe is a dragon,
go see Cal, go see Cal, go see Cal. If you're looking for a better set of wheels,
I will stand upon my head to beat all deals. I will stand upon my head till my ears are turning red. Go see Cal, go see Cal, go see Cal.
We're talking this hour about buying and selling cars, not bailouts in Washington, but the history of horse trading on the showroom floor. Country could use a few more car sales these days. Lots of dealerships really hurting. But the history here is long, and it seemed like an interesting moment to look back on it. Stephen Gilbert is with us. He's author of Horse Trading in the Age of cars. We've also been joined from Versailles, Kentucky, by Jack Kane, owner of Jack Kane Ford in Versailles. Been in the auto business for more than 50 years. You know what they sound like. Here's an 03 commercial for King Chevrolet in Tyler, Texas, starring not Jack Kane, who's with us, but Jack King Jr.
Hello, I'm Jack King Jr., inviting you to come to downtown Tyler. Biggest sale we've ever had. No holds barred. $5,000 off Impala, $7,500 off Silverados, $9,000 off Tahoes, $10,000 off Suburbans, or choose 0% financing for up to 72 months. You've been waiting for that deal to come along. You've waited long enough. Come take advantage of the 03 sale. You got to love it.
Whoopie tie-ia in 03. Now, here's a 1960 clip from a promotional video for the Chrysler 300F. Bob Roger, chief engineer of Chrysler Imperial, gives a tour of the car.
Now, for a moment, imagine yourself as driver of this automobile. And notice how this magnificent, unusual interior contributes to the overall theme of a functional, high-performance car. You'll notice a thrill of anticipation of things to come just in the appearance of these four individual bucket seats. And as a driver, you'll appreciate the convenience of swivel seats in entering a contoured chair-type seat.
You know, those swivel seats, those contoured chair-type seats, I guess we all have those these days. Let's get a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and David. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show.
Thanks. What do you know there, David?
Well, I was in the racehorse business and for 30 years in Ireland and England before I came to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the car business now for 20 years in Myrtle Beach.
So you went straight over from horses to automobiles. You know the path then.
Yeah, straight from one to the other. As a matter of fact, I came to Camden, South Carolina, was working in the horse business there, and I, by chance, got into the car business and been in it ever since. And absolutely love it. Great. Just a great way to make a living and a great way to meet people.
You're the guy who proves the point then. Do you see the similarities between buying and selling horses and cars, David?
Oh, yeah, there's a big similarity. It's all about selling. And I learned how to sell when I was basically 9 years of age. I bought a pony at a fair in Ireland, the Carmi Fair in County Cork. And loaded it on a train and took it on back home and then sold it to a rich businessman. So I learned pretty early how to do that, and it's held me in great stead all the way through. Of course, it's very different selling cars. You sell cars, it's a quick sale, whereas selling a horse can take 2, 3, 4 weeks, can take a little bit longer sometimes. Not that you want it to, but it's a different kind of a sale. For sure.
Yeah, of course, and not as much hay involved with the car, but there's the path from selling a pony at a fair in County Cork to cars in Myrtle Beach. David, thanks very much for calling. Jack Kane in Versailles, I mean, you're deep in this. You got 9 children, 5 of whom in the family car dealership business, started selling all the way back in 1947. What was it like then, Jack? You said before the break, not even a sticker on the car in 1947. Nowhere.
That's right. And the customer had to think a long time before he went into a dealership or a used car lot. He wanted to be sure he knew someone, or he would take several people with him as a mechanic and everything else, because he was strictly at the mercy then. Today, with all the codes of ethics we have, like with at NADA and with all the government regulations, and they came out with the Monroney sticker where every new car had to have a sticker on it. And then a few years later, every new truck had to have a sticker on it with the adverse suggested retail price. And that's just a suggested price. And we go from that and negotiate with the customer. And most times, it doesn't take but 2 or 3 hours at most to get a customer in a car today. Back then, it didn't take maybe 15 minutes because you didn't have all the regulations. You just had them sign a bill of sale of their car, and you notarized it and turned your car over to them. They borrowed their own money. We didn't arrange things for them.
Mm-hmm.
24 months was the average length of financing, if they did financing. If anyone went over 24 months, you knew they were in trouble. So, all the rates were at one price. It was 6%.
Stephen Gelber, you write about the 1950s as the real Wild West time of moving iron, of
right.
selling cars. Give us a sense
right.
of that.
Well, there were no automobiles manufactured during the war. So
because everything was tanks and jeeps,
everything was geared toward military equipment, mm-hmm. right? All the car companies went over to making jeeps and trucks and tanks and airplanes in some cases. And so when the war ended and all of the 12 million soldiers came back with their stored up pay and their families, they wanted to go out and they wanted what they had missed for years, not just during the war, but of course during the Depression mm-hmm. before that.
Right.
And so there was this tremendous pent-up demand and a real shortage of product. And so the price of cars, the demand for cars was so high that the price shot up. But the problem was, of course, that the dealers, or at least the manufacturers, understood they did not want to gouge the buyers. They didn't want to create a bad reputation for themselves. But at their level, the dealers wanted to make top dollar. And what developed was a gray market in which cars were sold, and then private parties would mark up and go around the corner, sell them to a used car dealer for more than they paid. And the used car dealer would then sell it for more than that. So there was such a demand for cars that it didn't matter what you were selling or how you were selling it.
And the sales techniques and tricks of that decade that made such a reputation, like what?
Right.
Like what?
And that, well, it wasn't necessary for the first 3 or 4 years after the war. There was mm-hmm. this demand. But then the demand was met. But the spirit of having to sell a lot of cars, the manufacturers demanded, the dealers often moved more cars than they really could. And so the dealers began using they cranked up using what used car dealers had done. And the term that was used after the war was blitz advertising. And of course, blitz is a term that refers to German military tactics. So it was not a term that was meant to compliment anybody. And blitz advertising was like the kind of advertising you played on the show just a few moments ago, the kind of screaming, yelling, no offer turned down, we'll pay top dollar. And
on that showroom floor, how did they move the iron, move the sleds?
Yeah, on the showroom floor, you got the development of what was called in the automobile business the system. And the system consisted of sometimes 2, 3, 4, up to 6 levels of turnovers, each one taking the customer who walked in off the street and ratcheting up the amount that they were asking, confusing them, sometimes hiding their car keys so they could not leave, and generally behaving in a way that made the customers so unhappy and so angry, requiring or telling them they had to buy all kinds of what was called a pack, sort of extra add-ons
yep.
at inflated prices. The system got so much out of hand that there was a demand that something be done about it. And that's what led in 1958 to the passage of the Monroney Act, which required that a sticker with the actual price be placed on the window of the car. That toned things down a bit, but the underlying system was there before the 1950s and has, as your callers have indicated, has continued since the 1950s, perhaps in a somewhat modified way.
We've got to ask Jack Kane about where all that's gone. Let's get a call first from Lansing, Michigan. And Dan. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
A little bit of history and then my question. I work for a company that provides a service to car dealerships, so I know several hundred salesmen. I know several dealership owners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've got an insight from there. Plus, you know, in the last 5 years, I've bought, you know, 5 or 6 cars. Some of my experiences were very easy. I don't like to call them good or bad. I like mm-hmm. to call them easy or hard.
Okay.
One of my hardest experiences was with a salesman who turned out to be a furniture salesman.
Mm.
That's where my question is leading. Mm-hmm. What about the source of salesmen? What makes a good salesman? What makes a salesman easy for a customer?
Let us pick it straight up. Jack Kane, how about it? It sounds like in your family, you may have had a bunch of them as children.
Yes.
That's one way to find.
I raised my salespeople. Now, what do you do? It's pretty easy to call out very quickly We have, as you know, we have all kinds of tests they take, things of this nature. Personality is important. Credibility is key. Just being a nice person, nice lady, being able to talk with people. We get them normally out of college. They've tried a few things, and it hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. They found that they can talk with people easily and do things like this. The thing that your other guest has mentioned, I would like to say in our area, was more the exception than the rule. We did have some dealers in our area that were gung-ho, blitzed, and everything else, and, mm-hmm. and hid cars and things of that nature. Most dealers in my area followed the golden rule because we're not in a high traffic district, not a metro market.
Okay.
We had to be better than anybody, had to be known better. And today, if a dealer gets off the path, the internet kills him and he's out of business. We're for having top-notch people in every department.
How is the internet changing the business, Jack? Do people, what percentage of people now walk in knowing the sort of, you know, all the numbers before they even sit down, and they're sort of come in and want to tell you what you're going to make on the
car? In our case, it's probably better than 85% because even our older customer, their children or grandchildren are going to help their parents or grandparents when they're buying a car, because usually you tell somebody when you're going to buy a car. The truck buyer is different. He just comes in and buys things of that nature. And, of course, the trucks are a big market in my area because I'm in the Lexington, Central Kentucky area mm-hmm. where horses are king. And so that's how the Internet has changed things. They also refer to the Internet. They know more about what they can haul, things of this nature, how many horses.
And do you love that or hate it when people come in knowing so much off the
Internet? I love it.
Why?
I love it. You know, because there's no argument. What he's looking for then is the best price and the best negotiated financing and everything that they can do. Because it is much better, because that eliminates all that shade of hypocrisy that exists in so many places. And so things we talk about and why you're having this program today.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a call from Atlanta, Georgia. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests.
Hi, Fred.
I've got some fond memories of going to the car dealership with my father, and he used to buy a new car every year. And he prided himself, and he was known as the best dealer around. If you wanted to get a good deal, you called my dad and went with him. But when I went in to buy my first car, I was 17 years old, and I wanted a Ford Mustang. And Dad said, I'll go with you, but we got to make a deal here. You have to listen and follow along with whatever I say. So we went in. I agreed to that, yeah. We mm-hmm. went in and talked. My dad talked a great deal. We got everything we wanted. We were about to sign on the dotted line, and my father says, there's no floor mats in that car. We need some floor mats, of course. And the dealer, you know, said, oh, my God, we're not going to be able to feed our kids.
You got to buy the floor mats.
I told you this mm-hmm. car's so cheap. Mm-hmm. And Dad said, well, we got to have some floor mats. And we couldn't come to an agreement. So, you know, my dad looked at me and he said, we got to walk. And I wanted that car so bad, you know.
Oh.
And but I walked. And he said, mark my words, they're going to call you back. So a couple of days later, we waited a couple of days. And sure enough, the salesman called us up. We had our floor mats and we had our deal. I had my car. And I was just wondering, question to Jack, how do you feel or how do you look at customers like that, like my father, who were really
dickering down to the last? Jack Kane?
We get them all the time, no doubt about it. And everyone, we want them to feel like they've made their very best deal. But today, he knows, your dad would know today exactly where I stood, things of that nature. And he says, well, I want you to make $500, but no more than that, things of this nature. And we have a lot of people that come in this way. And we just have to adapt to it. And we have to. We can't keep them on our lot and keep paying interest. We have got to turn the car.
Jack Kane, is there going to be an American auto industry this time next year?
Well, just as Stephen mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. during the war effort, everything shut down and they went 110% toward building things for the war. This, hopefully not, but could happen again. We can't afford to let this industry die. This is the first time, save Chrysler, in over 100 years that these companies have come for help. And it's mainly due to this fall of the Wall Street market that's creating a situation where we could get no cars sold because money was not available. Good people couldn't get a car.
Well, there's the bailout plea from Versailles, Kentucky.
Absolutely. It's not a bailout. It's a bridge loan to,
a bridge
to get these people going.
We'll make it your way right now, Jack. And the big dickering, of course, going on in Washington. Jack Kane of Jack Kane Ford, thank you very much for being with us, Jack.
Thank you, sir.
And Stephen Gelber, final yes. thoughts on where all this is headed? We've just got half a minute here, but it's a long and wonderful history you tell. Where's it going?
I don't see any change in the near future. There may be a bailout. There may be bridge loans. There may be changes in the internet. But the tradition of men meeting mano a mano on the showroom floor and negotiating a price rather than buying it from a sticker price, I think, is with us for the foreseeable future.
Stephen Gelber's new book is Horse Trading in the Age of Cars, Men in the Marketplace. Professor Gelber, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
We will go out with the horse and buggy rag, Dan Frechette. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I could be a high-rolling tycoon in the moonshine trade. Roll into town in my buggy coach and make my daily promenade. Oh, what could I do to get the horse and buggy days back? What'd I do? What'd I do? Why?